Tonight on Arena, Horselips will help us drive the cold winter away, Lynn Ramsey on Die My Love, and Ethan Ivrian plays live in studio. You can text us tonight on 51551, email arena at rte.ie, and we're on Instagram as well at rte_arena. Horselips, Ireland's groundbreaking Celtic rock band, released their album Drive the Cold Winter Away in 1975. And this week they're marking its 50th anniversary by releasing a new remastered vinyl edition of the album. The music on Drive the Cold Winter Away departs from the progressive rock style for which Horselips was renowned, instead gathering the band's favourite jigs, reels and ancient Gaelic carols into an acoustic soundscape with some mandolins, some fiddles and harmonies conjuring a warm seasonal tone. It was first recorded in a single week in Dublin's Trend Studios. It went on to earn the band gold status and widespread critical acclaim. And for this reissue, the music's been remastered at London's Abbey Road Studios. Before I talk to Barry Devlin and Jim Lockhart, let's take something from the album. This is the title track, Drive the Cold Winter Away. And that's just to give you a little sense of what the album sounds like. That's the title track from Drive the Cold Winter Away by Horselips. Barry Devlin and Jim Lockhart, you're both very welcome to Arena.
Thank you very much.
Who had the idea for this album initially? Was it always going to be a Christmas album, Barry?
My memory is that Eamon was a big fan of the Phil Spector Christmas album, and I remember he gave me a copy around about that time, the previous Christmas. And the idea of, well, we had thought for a while about doing a collection of acoustic traditional tunes, which we would often sit around and play in hotels when we had an idle moment. And we had never actually got around to, you know, we never thought about recording them, because what we were doing and what we were about was doing, and we were a rock and roll band that used Irish traditional motifs as a kind of an influence or as an ingredient. But we thought we had an idea at the back of our heads for a while that it would be nice to do a real acoustic album where we just indulged ourselves and just played this stuff. And so then, because of the time of year it was, it seemed like, wouldn't this be a lovely prank to do it as a Christmas album? And so Charles and I spent a lot of time that summer in the Kevin Street Music Library digging out old stuff, because there aren't a lot of Irish carols. Carols wasn't a thing in Irish, although they're like obviously all over the place in English and in Swedish and in German and everything. There's only a few, and we did a lot of digging, and the only ones we could find were Donaghadh the Mehel and Rugmur Amach the Ia, and then we found this Manx one, Na Cearí Fhadhnachta. And other than that, then it was instrumentals that had a kind of a Christmassy connection, and two lovely songs that Charles had from his repertoire from Northern England, The Snow Melts the Soonest and When a Man's in Love. And the whole thing kind of took on its own vibe. We recorded it, as you say, in a week, and it was a very kind of organic, self-driving process, really. We just went in and had a lot of fun, and it's one of my favourite Horselips albums, that and the Book of Invasions. It's a very surprising album, because we went down so many peculiar little side alleys, and we had so many odd instruments on it that there's always little surprises coming out when you listen back to it, particularly when you listen back to it with a kind of a remastering ear and you're paying attention to it, to little concealed details. Great fun.
So, Rick, does that answer your question?
It doesn't.
I thought that this has been the pre-recorded voice of Jim Lockhart with a number of facts.
That you sent your emissary, Jim, to answer the question is very impressive. I was looking at the list of albums that you'd recorded in around that time. You recorded it just before Book of Invasions. And there were about 9 albums in 7 years in and around that stage, from 1973 onwards.
That's about right, yeah.
What was the urge, Barry, other than obviously the what Jim has just said, to take out a week and to record something that essentially was just for yourselves?
Well, we'd been messing with inoffensive Irish tunes and kicking them about the place, and, you know, generally ruining their lives by incorporating them into loud and noisy rock and roll tracks. And in the process of doing the research for, you know, in the books like O'Neill's and that Charles and Jim had built up a big library of tunes that they knew and could play, and we would occasionally play them. And it suddenly it seemed like it would be a really nice idea to just play them without incorporating them into something entirely different. And that's what we did. But we also there's a certain amount of humour in the album. I mean, if you're a fan of the, you know, Irish Ceilidh bands, you'll hear that piano, and you know you'll hear that banjo, it's kind of playful, and the Sleeve Notes I think reflect this a bit. I mean, they're slightly twee, but one of them here says Barry Devlin played bass and grumbled a lot, and Eamon Carr hit out at a Bowron and a loose-skinned Arabian bongo. Derek Taylor was not in the studio. That's a very old Beatles joke. The script notes incorporate a number of Beatles jokes. But, you know, we're talking about 13.5-year-old boys having fun writing notes for an album. So there was a degree of that in it, wasn't there? It was funny, and at least it made us laugh.
Was an element of that simply because this was a project that you were almost just doing for yourselves? There was no pressure on you at all with regards to this.
It wasn't going to be released anywhere else. I mean, it was a sort of Kerrygold in reverse. We would only use this stuff in Ireland, but the rest of the world wasn't going to get it.
I realise it has been a while. Is there anything you remember specifically about the recording process itself, about that week when you went into studio?
Yeah, it was Fred Meyer.
I remember Fred Meyer testing the mics in the studio with his own inimitable style. He would stride through the studio with all these expensive Neumanns and stuff and just bang, bang, poof, 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 poof. And if you happened to have headphones on at the time, you would be wiping the blood off your shoulder blades.
But it was the kind of robust approach that these tunes and us, well, we demanded. We had a week in studio, and that sounds in a way sounds a bit rushed. But in fact, it was
relaxed enough. We had done a bit of pre-production work on, but I mean, as a recording, like normally we would have taken 2 months or so to put an album together at that stage. So in our terms, this was really lashing it down. But it was pretty relaxed. It was good fun.
Yeah, in fact, 2 months would have been a very, very long album for Oysters.
Well, including pre-production and
pre- and post-production. Yeah, yeah. And all that. We did get through, I mean, we got through 12 albums in 10 years. So we were firing them out. We didn't do the 2 films that we thought we might fit in. But my memory of it is that it was really good fun. And unlike Unplugged, where I didn't play bass at all, I did play a bit of bass on this.
You played bass on it. There's lovely bass, like on When a Man's in Love. There's great bass on this. That's the only electric thing on it, I think, isn't it?
I think that's probably right. Yeah. And but I mean, it was fun to watch Johnny and Charles and Jim and Eamon do interesting things that, you know, with tunes that didn't involve, like I say, kicking them around the studio. Just let them be.
Johnny didn't get much of a chance normally to play banjo, so it's lovely to hear banjo sort of plunking out on this. Great.
Actually, Johnny was God rest him, was a brilliant banjo player, really, really fine player. He could frail with the best of them. And you know, he had that background of doing the Flas. You know, we actually bought him from Ted Fury in Newcastle West, where he was.
You make him sound like he was indentured. Jim, tell me about the decision then to just release this album in Ireland. Was that what was behind that?
We were trying to sort of build a career as a rock and roll band, a kind of prog rock band, and so to let this out would have been commercial suicide to let it out outside of Ireland, because people wouldn't have known what to make of it, and it would have completely stymied any kind of band identity. I recently came across a prog rock site where elderly gentlemen, it's always blokes who get into prog rock, get together and they discuss the second Gentle Giant album or the fourth Genesis album. And a couple of them had come across this, had come across Drive the Cold Winter Away, and they were very puzzled. They're terribly, you know, it's always, it tends to be sort of English guys who have sort of very refined musical tastes. And they were, this isn't prog rock. I do very much like it. And the instrumentation and the playing is really quite impressive. But prog rock it isn't, I'm afraid. So I'm going to have to mark it down.
Tell me about the remastering process for this, because it was done at Abbey Road. What is the process for those people that maybe don't necessarily understand about an album being remastered? Is it solely something that you send away and is done elsewhere? Do you as band members have a role in this? How does that work?
Yeah, you do. The mastering initially, it's a bit of a black art, and mastering for vinyl was always a black art because there's a kind of floor level of surface noise on vinyl, which is imperceptible now, really. But in the old days, particularly if you got kind of recycled vinyl, you had to structure the kind of the sound profile. You had to compress it slightly, but in tasteful ways. When CDs came along, you didn't have to do that compression because you could pretty much transfer a studio master tape to CD as was. That didn't last very long because producers soon realised that you could do much more. And so if you look at, for example, an Oasis CD, the needles go right around to 9.5 and they stay there. They don't move. In the old days, you would see needles going up and down as there'd be a certain amount of air. The air got kind of pumped out of early CD mastering. Newer vinyl remastering involves going in and sweetening the sound to some degree, or, you know, it's a matter of taste. You can make it sharper, you can make it sweeter, you can make it softer, you can take a particular frequency and bring it up depending on your tastes. What this one does, I think, is this particular remaster is it clarifies the vocals. The vocals, I think, are somewhat clear. But I mean, you'd be listening to it and you think, am I really hearing that, or am I thinking?
That's a question for both of you, because did either of you discover anything through re-listening to the remastered versions of this that maybe you'd forgotten, or maybe that you just hadn't really realised was there in the first place?
Yeah, the Charles's vocal is just gorgeous. I was so impressed with Charles's vocal, and it lifts out of the mix slightly more in a way that I don't think it did on the previous versions. But as I say, that's pretty subjective. But you keep getting, one of the things about listening to it again is that, as I say, I found I was surprised by suddenly, oh, I didn't realise we put a banjo in there. Oh, listen, there's another harpsichord in that. Oh my God, there's another keyboard. And oh, what's Eamon doing there? That's got to be bongos. No, it's not. It's baron. No, it's not. It's congas. So it's great fun listening back to it in detail.
What's that been like for you, Barry, listening back to it after all this time?
One of the great delights of listening back to it is hearing how good a singer Jim is. And he sings a Manx carol called Na Cirí Faoi Nochtaí.
Your fiver is in the post.
And I think he should be made to sing it at once.
I think the sensible thing now might be to play the version off the album, which I think we might do. This is Na Cirí Faoi Nochtaí. It comes from the Isle of Man, and this is Jim Lockhart on vocals. Okay, so that is Jim Lockhart on vocals. Jim, the Manx Christmas carol there, it's called Na Cirí Faoi Nochtaí, The Sheep Are Buried Under the Snow. It's written in Manx. Tell me about coming across that and then why you decided to sing it.
We found it in a collection of stuff, as I said, in Kevin Street Library. And I don't think I'd come across Manx written before. Manx is very closely related, as far as I can see, to Ulster Irish, not particularly Donegal Irish, but the Irish that would have been around Oriel, which was say, stretched from Monaghan across to Louth. So you can see connections, you can see similarities between that and that kind of Irish with a slight northern accent. It's not as far across as Scots Gaelic. It's closer to Irish than Scots Gaelic. It didn't have its own written tradition as Irish had. It was written down initially in, I think, the 17th century under the aegis of a Welsh cleric who had been used to reading or been used to seeing Welsh written, and so he wrote it down phonetically, and there's lots of Y's and double L's and stuff, so it looks kind of odd, but when you pronounce it you can hear the similarities with Irish. You can hear, because I mean, it's like Elon Vananon is the island of Mananon MacLir, and it's just they're our little brothers. And the Manx died out, I think the last native speaker died in 1974. But there is a fairly healthy revival project going on, and I think they're starting schools in Manx and stuff like that. But that was a bit of a find, and that was to patch up the lack of actual Irish carols. Not too many of them around.
And Wikipedia has made geniuses of us all, but I mean that was out of Kevin Street. I mean, you went off and did original research into
proper books and all
that you have to open.
When you had to go into a library to do that kind of thing,
mark the page with chewing gum, that kind of thing.
They would not have approved that in Kevin Street Library. Barry, did you consider when you were re-releasing this album about that you might potentially be tapping into a whole new generation of either Horselips fans or trad music fans?
Yeah, I'd love to think that. You know, in our dotage, we started to get, you know, just before it's written on tombstones, we're starting to get some respect, dude. This was brought home to me the other night, a few months ago, when I was in my local Circle K below, at the bottom of Doggy, in bottom of Castle Street, which, as you can imagine, is a pretty rough joint. I noticed a bunch of kids, like 14 and 15-year-olds, who are moving restlessly among the cabinets past the Haribo packs. And they were gradually ganging up on me. And my age, I'm kind of going, kids are really scary, and these are at a very scary age. And it was clear they were surrounding me. And eventually they did surround me. And one of them leaned in and said, "Are you the guy from Horselips?" And I was so thrilled. I mean, these guys had obviously, I think that's the guy from Horselips. And, you know, so there is a generation, there's the generation after the first generation, which was Italia 90, who discovered through da-da-da. And the new film, Saipan, has got da-da-da-da as it. So there may be another generation who are going to not know who the hell we are, but we know that tune, you know.
But you see, it's always blokes. Plus ça change.
Do you think part of that is to do with the accessibility of music these days? In that, you know, 25 years ago, if you wanted to listen to a Horselips album, or that album in particular, you had to physically source an actual copy of it somewhere in the real world. Whereas these days, in the space of two clicks, anybody who's listening to us right now can listen to what we've just been playing.
Yeah, I mean, this is the key to the whole thing. We're going in tonight to a gig by a girl called Rose Betts, who I bet
she's fantastic.
Yeah, she's brilliant.
Yeah.
But most people don't know about her. What I know about her, well, I love her stuff, but she gets 13 million hits every time she puts something out, and it's all on social media. And they're really great songs, but in a way they have, you know, she's not bothered with that level above, which is like Spotify based.
Yeah.
This is just people who know that there's going to be a Rose Betts single. And I think that kind of thing is highly to be commended, because it means that people who don't have the backing of large record companies can make their own way. And if they write songs that people like, and especially someone like Rose, who writes beautiful songs, then that's out there.
What doesn't surprise me in the slightest is that if I was not presenting this radio show tonight, I would be in Bellow Bar going to see Rose Betts, because she's extraordinary. She's fantastic and people should listen to her.
What a thing.
Yeah. Can I give you just something that's come in on text? Gahalin, great taste. I had the privilege to meet Horslips years ago while I was hiking in the Dublin Mountains. It sounds like you all out on a group outing. But myself and my gang got a bit lost and came upon their little hideout cottage. I needed to spend a penny and they invited us in a rainy wet gear to use their facilities. I'm a big fan of the music ever since. Ger Cass from Inchicore in Dublin 8.
Good God.
Yay!
Wow.
I'm going to finish up by playing.
That would that have been in a scary. Anyway, yeah.
You make it sound like you have multiple cottages. I'm going to finish off with playing something else from the album. But any more plans for remasters after this? Is this a rolling project?
We don't know. Because when we think we've emptied whatever barrel is there, some other barrel rolls along. So, the amazing thing about this era is that there's stuff that you thought was lost forever, somebody comes up with, and we've come across live recordings that we had completely forgotten about or thought were lost. At one stage we sent a whole bunch of live radio recordings back from America to London, all wrapped up in tape, so that in foil, so they'd be able to go through the airport scanners safely, and they never arrived. And we thought, well, that's a bummer. That's a whole load of live recordings. And then, 20, 30 years later, thanks to the internet, they started to pop up here and there. And we started to hear this stuff. Guys in attics in Ohio and Idaho with tape machines were taping this stuff off the wireless. So you never know what's going to crop up.
It has been a joy to talk to both of you tonight. Barry Devlin, Jim Lockhart, thanks a million for coming in. The newly remastered Horslips album, Drive the Cold Winter Away, is available now wherever you buy your fine vinyl. And we're going to finish with this track. This is Dennis O'Connor. And you're listening to Arena. The Scottish director Lynn Ramsay has carved out a unique space in modern film. From the unforgettable and unsettling atmosphere of her feature breakthrough Morvern Kallar to the harrowing study of destructive motherhood in We Need to Talk About Kevin, Ramsay has consistently immersed us in the intense, often turbulent psychological landscapes of her characters. Now, after an 8-year hiatus from making feature films, she is back with her new film Die My Love, starring Jennifer Lawrence and Robert Pattinson as love up couple Grace and Jackson. An adaptation of a novella by Arianna Horwitz, the film is an uncompromising portrait of a young mother's descent into a terrifying yet darkly funny psychosis as her new life in a remote and lonely new home begins to unravel. The film features a powerhouse performance from Jennifer Lawrence, which, as they say, already has Oscar buzz. It was co-written by Irish playwright Enda Walsh and shot by Irish cinematographer Seamus McGarvey. Sinead Egan recently caught up with Lynn Ramsay to talk about Die My Love, but before we bring you that conversation, let's take something from the film. In this scene, Jennifer Lawrence as new mum Grace is at a pool party where she receives unwelcome sympathy from one of the other mothers.
So do you think you'll have another one?
Yeah, pregnant now.
Cooking up twins.
What happened to your hands?
Oh, you should see the wall.
Yeah, I am. I have two kids, and two is a lot, if I'm being honest.
Seems like it.
Babies, though. Babies are hard. I don't think anybody talks about that enough.
It's all anyone talks about.
It changes you. I think I nearly lost my mind for the first 6 months.
When do you think you'll be getting it back?
You know, postnatal depression is so much more common than people think. I think I'm gonna give it a shot. What do you do for work, Craze?
I don't.
Oh.
I'm stuck between wanting to do something and not wanting to do anything at all.
Oh, hang on. Cheryl mentioned that you're a writer. That's cute. That must be nice, having something you can kind of squeeze around a bit.
Yeah, I don't do that anymore.
Why not? Stuck for inspiration? I'm sure it'll come back.
Lynn Ramsay, welcome to Arena.
Lynn, tell us about Grace and where she is at the start of the film, what point she is in her life when we meet her.
Well, I think I always saw them as a couple who maybe been a young couple, maybe living in New York, not rich or anything. I think she's publishing work. I mean, it's based in a novel, this material, but so, you know, we'll talk about that in a minute. But you know, they don't have a lot of money. They inherit this house, you know what I mean? Like, you know, in the most bonkers way, you know what I mean? In the film, but not in the book. And I just think, you know, like, what starts off is a, it's about, you know, isolation. Like, you know, her and her husband stop having sex. She stops working, you know. She becomes very bored, and she's like a wild animal. She's a bit like a beast. But I think at the beginning of the film, there's this kind of hope, you know, this new place, and it kind of gradually erodes.
So the film explores her psychological breakdown, this really incremental day-to-day way in which everything overtakes her. She's a new mother. She's isolated, as you've said. So for you making the film, what was the biggest challenge in translating such a turbulent inner world onto the screen?
Well, I was aided by some great actors, you know, and I think she was very unapologetic, you know, even like in Arianna Hardwich had written this, you know, very cool little novella, you know, like very well written. One thing I really loved it is that she's quite fearless. She's quite unapologetic. She says things that like people wouldn't like to say sometimes, but people don't, or, you know, like, and I just saw this kind of unraveling, but I always saw it as quite strong, quite fierce. Like, you know, I never saw it as, like, you know, that we, that she needs to get her sympathy all the time. I didn't want to play it as that kind of character or a weak character, you know what I mean? So it's really like, I suppose, aided by Jennifer Lawrence, some great text, you know what I mean? And just my instinct that how to go with this and thinking about her, like, is quite feral. That's how I started, you know?
Gonna leave it?
If you're a girlfriend, you clean it up.
Nice.
You're pissed on the floor, too. You should make better choices on who you bring home.
For fuck's sake, Grace.
Why are you mad at me?
Why didn't you just let him out, you wet dog?
He's not my problem.
Just put him on his leash. Take him out the back until he gets used to where he is.
Yeah, I'm not gonna train your fucking dog.
Yeah, a baby.
No shit!
I can't. This place is a fucking hole.
And you moved us into it.
I am working. And when I come home, I'm the one cleaning everything up.
Oh, God. 3 days a week. Let me shower you in metals.
Shut up.
You have an ashtray on the carpet. You don't think the baby's eating that shit?
Shut up.
When you were working with Jennifer, and I believe she brought the novella to you and was really keen to get the film made. When you were working with her, how did you work on maintaining Grace, maintaining the audience's empathy? Because as you say, she's not an easy character. She's not playing for everybody's sympathy all the time. She's tough and she's really complicated.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, Jennifer had sent me the novel, right? And I read it, but I was like, this is unfilmable. You know, it's like too many layers. It's a great piece of literature, you know. But I didn't get back right away or anything. I was thinking I was going to make this film called Stone Mattress, which I'm hoping still to make. Mm-hmm. And so, like, but then we just started discussing it. And I think, you know, just like, you know, she just kind of implicitly, I what put me off a bit at first, I was like, am I going into the territory of we need to talk about Kevin, because I don't want to do that. And as I started seeing it more like a bit, a love story, more like a couple unraveling as well, and sex unraveling and all the crazy things that happen in marriages, and like, you know, and so it's got many layers to it. So we talked a lot before making it. But there's a kind of humour that she brought always, and I think always undercut it, you know? Like, so I said, I really wanted it to be funny, like in places, like it's a black humour. And she's just a natural comedian, you know? And she does, you know, there was a scene where she just like, there's a certain animalistic quality in her and how she moves and stuff. And she's really bored in the house one day and she's like doing stupid things with oranges and throat, you know, she's just bored and like the house is getting a mess. And she walks up to this window, which becomes like a kind of thing in the film later, you know, where you see the forest lit out. And she just licked the window in the take, you know. I sound like there's not a lot of Hollywood actresses who can got like the dirty window. You know, you just like, there's something like a beast in her. But I love that she just, She'd be funny. She'd be unapologetic. She would be annoying. Like, I mean, you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like that was part of me. It's like that's why I liked it, because it wasn't like this weak character. It's like, you know, having a breakdown. It's like this strong character, you know, that might be going somewhere stronger in her mind. And Jackson doesn't really know how to handle it, you know?
You mentioned before that you explored themes of troubled motherhood before in We Need to Talk About Kevin in particular. So can you expand a little bit about what drew you to revisit this theme with this story? What was the new territory that you found?
Well, to me, it was like I saw it more. I mean, and I think I said this pretty early on, maybe to Jennifer as well, because I was like, I knew I didn't want to go the same direction as that. I never wanted to make the same kind of movie. Like, to me, it was themes in a marriage as well, themes in love, themes when you stop having sex, themes when she gets a creative blog, and, you know, like, you know, which might be, you know, like, is she a nymphomaniac even, you know what I mean? Like, there's lots of different, like, kind of layers to it and stuff like that. And she has this baby and she's stuck alone, things isolation, you know. But I don't think she doesn't love the baby, you know. I think it's just like,
no,
you know,
definitely. She really does. You can really feel that.
Yeah, she really does. Yeah. And I think this couple love each other as well, but he just doesn't, she, you know, the more she spirals and spins out of control, I don't know, but I think he loves her. So I saw it as a sort of love story in a way, a sort of fairy tale love story. You know, when marriages just kind of go into this mad oblivion, you know, this guy really truly loves her. He just doesn't understand her, you know, doesn't get her, you know.
He's your mangy dog, and sanctimonious means that you think you're morally superior to other people, Demi.
Where's your book going, by the way?
Fantastic, thank you.
Your great American novel.
The main character is about to batter her husband to death with a hammer.
Sounds like shit.
Well, you can't read, so.
Maybe. Spend
You worked with the Irish cinematographer Seamus McGarvey on this project. How did you and he approach the visual language of the film? What were you both aiming for?
Oh, Seamus is a very old friend, man. You know, like, he invited me for dinner, I think, last night, you know, or the night before. But I worked with him and we need to talk about Kevin, you know, and he's such a charming man, and, like, and he's a real intellectual as well. He's, like, really talks about content. You know, some DPs just talk technical, yeah. Seamus is not that guy. So it's funny, we walked in, the visual language came quite early. We were both quite shocked at the prep time. We were like, oh my God, we don't have a lot of time to do tests, like in cast and stuff like that. So we found this location. It looked really, it was something really strange about it, but it had this kind of layered, like, and a door in it, and this, that which became, it's thematic as well, where you see the forest beyond. So we did all these tests, and it's great working with him because you're just in this zone, you know, and then. Yeah. So we really sort of bounced off each other, and there was a great moment with him where the light was going down, where we knew we were like, it was going to get dark, we couldn't shoot. He was like lying in the grass, like this, you know, Calgary field, you know, like looks, you know, like cornfields, and we're both like we were both thinking, God, how are we going to do this? Because like, there's no way, because it was a scene, like quite a long scene. Domestic, he's flipping a burger, he asked him earlier, and then Seamus, I just crawled up to Seamus, like in this grass, you know, like, and we both were going, how are we going to do it, you know what I mean? And we just went, bingo, let's just do it in the grass, you know, like it's that. So we, and it's actually one of our favourite scenes, and so they pad in the grass, and you know, and it was like, it was nice, but it was like this moment, it was in the most beautiful light, where we just found it. And we just came up with ideas, and I had to run to the actors. I said, look, we're changing that whole scene. We're just shooting it like you both crawling in the grass, you know. But we have that natural language between us. He's an amazing guy, you know.
And that's a really beautiful scene, and it felt really organic in the film as well. Finally, Lynn, there isn't much art made about postnatal depression. So when you embark on a project like this as a director and as a writer, what kinds of conversations are you hoping that it will prompt among people?
Well, I mean, I suppose, like I say, I didn't see quite like just postnatal. I thought as when some, you know, this kind of this isolation quality, and I saw it like that love story more, or the isolation in a couple, and when sex stops and all those kind of things. But I think Jennifer had, like, really, you know, she'd actually experienced, like, you know, like, you know, this kind of feeling you become separate from yourself as a woman, you know. You're becoming new. You're not a being anymore. You're not a sexual being anymore, you know, like, especially in this marriage, you know. So I think that this kind of stuff we were talking about before, you know, embarking on it.
Well, Lynn Ramsay, congratulations on the film. Warmest congratulations on the film. And thanks for talking to Arena this evening.
Well, thanks so much, Sinead. Yeah.
You off your food, Grace? Leave her alone.
You didn't eat.
Being pregnant makes your stomach shrink.
That's bullshit.
And sucking on you every minute of the day. Then Jim. You'll be famished. I couldn't get enough in me.
That never really went away, did it?
You can talk. What's your excuse?
Never had a baby in there, but always hate as though you just dropped triplets. You know, Grace, if you get a screamer...
She's not going to get a screamer.
Jackson was a screamer.
That's a lie.
Jackson was a sweetheart.
The point is, if you do, let the baby cry. Just walk away from it. Don't let yourself get tired, stressed.
It's a horrible thing to say.
Oh, fucking death. If you're not at your best, it's no good for anyone, especially the baby.
Lots of unwanted advice there from expectant mother Grace, from amongst others Sissy Spacek, who plays her mother-in-law Pam in Die My Love. Before that, we heard Lynn Ramsey talking about the film, which opens in Irish cinemas on Friday. We'll be reviewing it here on Thursday night. And you're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. The West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival's Winter Weekend returns to the Manor House Tulfaris from the 14th to the 16th of November, featuring performances from some of Ireland's leading classical musicians. Amongst them is violinist Aoife Nivrian, who'll appear with Welsh harpist Catherine Finch. The pair will perform a programme that blends classical and traditional music, including pieces from their joint album W. Aoife comes from a well-known musical family. She studied and performed across Europe and continues to explore the connection between Irish traditional and classical styles, and she's also about to release a new album with composer and pianist Cormac McCarthy called Cosán Casta. Aoife joins me in studio now. Welcome to Arena.
Thank you so much, Rick. It's lovely to be here.
I'm going to ask you to play something to begin with. Maybe you'll introduce it to us and tell us what you're about to do.
Absolutely. So I'm going to play the prelude of the Partita in E major by Bach, which I recently released a version of with Catherine, but... funnily enough, the harp can't play this piece in E major, only in E flat. So when I get to play it by myself, I play it in the original key. But yeah, it's our most recent single and it's a really beautiful piece of music.
Okay, take it away. Thank you. Very few times I'm allowed to close my eyes in this studio, and that was a wonderful Aoife Ní Briain performing some Bach for us. Aoife, describe what you do, and by that I mean you seem to move between classical music and Irish traditional, and just off air we were talking about your new project, which kind of has jazz influences to us. Tell us about that.
I think the correct phrase is a jack of all trades, master of none. I seem to have managed to land myself in the most peculiar of positions in the world of music, but I was born into a very traditional music family. So my dad's an Uilleann piper, his name is Mick O'Brien, and my mum, Fidelma, is a traditional music teacher. She's taught hundreds of people music around the north side of Dublin. But I started playing classical music when I was 2 years old with Maria Kettleman, who was just the most phenomenal teacher, and never looked back. So ended up studying in Leipzig. That's where I found my love of Bach and all things Baroque with Mariana Sirbu, who was just a huge influence on me, a Romanian violinist who actually used to be the leader of the RTE Academica Quartet here, so had a huge connection to Ireland. Then I met the likes of Catherine Finch, the incredible Welsh harpist. We made our own new sound world between violin and harp and hardanger and harp. And then I met Cormac McCarthy, the phenomenal jazz pianist. So we have a new record coming out. And I'm working with Liam Byrne, the viola da gamba player who lives in Berlin. So that's a whole other Baroque project. And then Nurith Stark, the violinist. We have a violin duo as well. So it just couldn't be more diverse.
It might have been easier for me to ask, is there anything you're not doing?
I'm definitely not playing the saxophone or doing anything particularly cool with the big band.
So let me ask you about then that event at the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival. It is with Catherine Finch, the Welsh harpist. Tell us about that concert and about the sort of music the two of you are creating together.
So it's really interesting with Catherine because, you know, she's a classically trained harpist, but, you know, comes from Wales, where harp is the national instrument. And there's so much Welsh traditional music that is accessible to play on the harp, whether you're classically trained or brought up in it from like in a traditional household or not. And we play the standard. So we'll be playing Sanson's Fantasy for violin and harp, which is one of the like big pieces in the classical repertoire for this duo combination. But what we found was we weren't particularly overly enamoured with the other options available, so we just started writing our own music. So we do our own versions of like Locatelli caprices on the hardanger and the harp, where we've kind of completely taken it apart and put it back together again in our own way with maybe a Scandinavian inspired folk tune over it. Or we have kind of a tango that's called Waggle. It's all to do with the bees and the waggle dance, and that, you know, it has hints of libertango in it. I don't know, it's really, really hard to explain. To be honest, when Catherine and I met each other, it was during COVID. We hadn't played with anybody in a very long time. And when we sat down to make music, I think what we really did was just played from the heart, and all these feelings came out of just joy and excitement and creativity, because we hadn't had this chance to work with another person in so long. And it was a very emotional album and a very cathartic album for us as well. Like, it really helped us through that kind of COVID time. And we've been playing together ever since, and we're about to go into the studio in 2 months to record our next album. So it's going from strength to strength.
Okay, I'm going to ask you just before we finish out to play something else for us. What is it going to be?
I will play a piece, a Welsh piece, which has the most hilarious title. It's called Queen Mamon Hovereith, which means My Mother-in-Law's Lament. And Wales is very well known for its very terribly sad tunes, but this is actually one of the most jolly ones I've ever heard, so it's a bit of an ironic title. But I just want to say I'm very excited to play in West Wicklow Festival, and if people are planning on coming to the concert, there's an incredible concert on the same day at 5 p.m. with Rosanna Philipson's and Finian Collins, and if people can make it to both, you should not miss it. But really looking forward to having Catherine over here and to play for that audience.
Okay, here we go. That's a fine way to finish out any programme. Aoife ni Briain, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much, Arena.
Aoife will be at the West Wicklow Chamber Music Festival on Saturday, November 15th, alongside harpist Catherine Finch, performing works from their album Double U. Tickets at westwicklowfestival.com. And that is it for tonight's Arena. Reg Luby produced. Paula Shields was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. And James Feeney was on sound supervision. I'm Rick O'Shea. We'll talk to you again tomorrow night from 7 o'clock, live from the Dublin Book Festival. And I hope you can join us then. We'll see you tomorrow.